good trip to the fourth dimensional space pyramid that is your brain. So.
Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Audible Autism, Interesting Questions and Interesting Facts. On this episode, we have Ted.
Hi.
and obviously Odai.
Hi.
I'm co-host, and I'm Sarah, your co-host. So, Ted, you are a dancer.
Yes.
So, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into that and how you see that interacting with your autism?
Okay, so I started dancing when I was 3 years old. I'm 27 now, so it's a bit of time. And my parents took me to the Edinburgh Tattoo. I was about to say in Edinburgh. And there were some people doing Highland dancing over the swords, cross swords. And I was just like, I want to do that.
Cool.
And that was basically it. We were living in Scotland at the time, so they took me to Highland dancing lessons. I loved it. I was quite good at it. And then we moved to England when I was seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a bit of Highland here for a while. But then it's not as big in England, unless you're in Corby, which is kind of an odd place in the Midlands with a big Scottish community.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and then
it's not big in London?
Not really, not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's a big thing in Scotland. Like, it's a very traditional dance. You compete. It's like, it's a bit Dance Moms. It's very intense, like lots of hairspray and high socks. It's really intense. But yeah, like when I moved to England, I just like transitioned to like an after school stage school and did like started with jazz and then tap and then modern and ballet and just sort of did the lot and then went and studied it professionally, and now I do it professionally.
Mm,
yeah.
Cool. What was the proudest moment that you had in dancing?
Oh. Doing the new Mary Poppins movie. Or maybe also, proudest is different. And maybe dancing for Florence and the Machine as well. I think at Hyde Park, because it was a sold out show and I'd never done a live performance to that many. It was like 50,000 people and it was just nuts. So for me, that was a proud moment. And also because I do loads of like really great underground stuff, but it was nice that my parents and my sister could really relate to that show, you know. So I think it was the first time in years that they had really seen me dance in something as, I don't want to use the word legitimate, but as knowable as that. Yeah.
Cool. And when did you first realise you're autistic?
I was diagnosed when I was 17 and I didn't really know what it was properly. I was diagnosed in a stay in a psychiatric unit when I'd sort of become very unhappy, and they basically handed me my notes, which I don't think they're supposed to do, but they did, and I read on my notes long-standing diagnosis of Asperger's, and I thought that my parents had been lying to me for 17 years. So I was furious and called them up, and they were like, no, 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 no. And so they'd basically been studying me whilst I was in the hospital and found a diagnosis then. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't really know what it was, but I did, I guess I had an idea and I did some reading. To be honest, it made a lot of sense.
Mm.
Like, it made so much sense.
Mm. And dancing is quite an extroverted profession and possibly not something that people associate with being autistic. Do you see the two as related or in spite of? Or
I personally think completely related.
Mm.
I mean, there's aspects that are particularly challenging. For example, just before a show, the sort of level of adrenaline and nerviness and therefore the sort of effect that has on your body is quite horrific to deal with, especially if you're performing regularly. And also like the come down feeling after a show or a body of work is really extreme. But actually, in regards to like picking up choreography, observing, being very detailed, and actually the feeling when you, sometimes when you first learn something, it can feel clunky, but when you repeat the movement, the feeling and the sort of depth of feeling you get from dance and the positive effect, therefore, that can have on your body, for me is, I think, very, very related to my autism. It's like anything sensory, it can be complete elation or it could be hell. So I think if you manage to channel it in a positive way, it's absolutely wonderful. But yeah, I mean, it does certainly come with some big challenges. I would also say in relation to like audiences, because I guess people might say, oh, like, how do you cope with that many people watching you or having to share with that many people? So for me, like, sharing, it is quite a generous thing, and it does take a big toll on you. But again, if the response is good, it's just this huge reward. So again, it's like, it's all this positive feedback and information coming back at you, which again, it's wonderful. And I'd say that the only real negative thing is like the bit before the show, or having to like go into the bar after the show is so horrible and weird. You've got all these people with like an opinion or an expectation, and you're supposed to just like walk into this room full of people and celebrate, and I'm like, can I have a massage and go to bed? It's always would be my preferred thing.
You were going over when you're 17 and you're now 27.
As of Monday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so I was just interested to know, obviously it sounds like you went off and read all about it, how your conceptualisation of autism had changed in the last 10 years.
When I first was diagnosed, I sort of thought about it for a minute and then forgot about it.
Mm.
Like, I was angry about it in that moment, and then I was just like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Like, may as well carry on if I've been it this whole time.
Mm.
You know, just get on with it. And I think in the last 10 years, it's just become more and more relevant to my life. And in many ways, there's been more and more challenges to deal with. Like having to adult full stop, you know, having to try and like find a home, figure out how to work, you know, figure out how to do your taxes and forms, or like how to ask for help, or Yeah, I mean, there's just so many more challenges, and actually, I don't want to sound negative about it, but I feel like it's actually becoming more and more challenging and relevant, and maybe also because I'm more aware of it. I'm not like pissed off about it, not about me being autistic, but about having to constantly figure myself out to explain it to someone, and that, particularly in the last 6 months to a year, has been a real big thing to me. I think also because I'm in an intimate relationship with my partner, who I love very much, but that has been a real big mirror to, you know, things that otherwise I wouldn't have to deal with. So yeah, my perception or my conceptualization has changed in that. I used to try and have it as a non-thing in my life, and now it's very much a thing, but also very much a driving factor and a positive thing.
Mm.
Like, I think it shapes my work a lot, and it actually gives me some direction in my life, because I know there's work to be done. Mm. So I feel useful in applying my knowledge and my skills and my art or whatever to the cause of helping autistic people.
I think the last time we met, you were telling me about a workshop that you'd done.
When I formulated.
Huh? Yeah.
Vogue Chi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about that.
So, first of all, what does Vogue Chi mean?
Vogue Chi. Like Vogue. Like, strike a pose.
Oh, okay.
But not Madonna, because she stole it.
Yeah.
Cool. Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, like, New York, 80s, Latinx, African-American Vogue. So a friend of mine and I formulated a workshop called Vogue Chi. We were both living in Margate at the time, and we both wanted to teach something with dance that wasn't just teaching a dance class.
Mm.
We both have spent a lot of time in the queer club scene. It's transformed our lives massively, so we thought, let's include that. And then there was we'd both previously said, actually, that we wanted to teach people who weren't our age. And then there was a funding available to teach people over 50. So we were like, right, let's teach over 50s the spiritual principles of queerness via catwalking. But then we also thought, as they might be non-dancers, we can use the Tai Chi element and slow some of the movement down, but also use the idea of energy manipulation in a physical sense, and I guess what like might look like quite base practices of like pulling the offensive word out of the air and massaging it into your skin and turning it to something else. But
I'm sorry, the what?
So for example, we do an exercise, we adapt some of the Vogue dance techniques. So like, you know, often Vogue is about presenting yourself in the way that you want to, in a very beautiful way. So like, if you are proud of your skin, you will present your skin, you will show your skin to the judges' table, you will catwalk your skin, you know, and in Paris is Burning, there's a very famous moment where the girl says, like, touch my skin, touch all of my skin, you know, so it's very indulgent. So we would borrow that and go, okay, so in life people sometimes throw nasty shit at you. You know, I've been called a faggot, I've been called fat, I've been called greasy, you know, whatever, and think of a word that may have held you back or may have stopped you or hurt you. Literally pull it out of the air,
mm-hmm.
bring it to your hands, like warm it up in your hands until you can feel the words melting, you know, and then all of a sudden the words have melted and they're an indulgent cream, you know, it's lovely. So you start to moisturize in it, and like you moisturize your skin because you've taken control of the word, you know, and now you're presenting the word in the way you want to present it, in this beautiful way, or you're dispelling the word, you know.
Just to interject, I mean, the listeners can't actually see what's going on, but I think your description of it was very visual and conceptual, and I'm sure it came through very well. But it's...
I think they also probably heard him with the...
Yeah, of course, that too.
I'm rubbing my arms. I'm moisturising.
And how did the other 50s take it?
They loved it. So we started, we were given 10 weeks at the Turner Gallery in Margate. We didn't know what was going to happen. And we didn't know if it was going to be terrible or wonderful. But we had a good feeling about it. So I think we were happy to pursue it. And it literally changed some of their lives. And now there's a legitimate Vogue Chi community in Margate. Friendships have been formed. People have changed things in their life and their life decisions. And, you know, even I was about to say small things, not very small, but Margate was it was a UKIP constituency before. And now, I mean, not solely due to Vogue Chi, but it's become a Labour majority. And I think it just... It did what we hoped it would do, which is it opened people's minds both for themselves and for others, you know, and I think that has a universal impact, not just for queer peoples or peoples of colour or people from clubs or whatever, but for everyone, you know, maybe for autistic people too. It was just encouraging people to care for themselves and, I don't know, indulge their positivity a bit more instead of being like British and drudgy and, you know, down on yourself all the time, which is so, I think it's quite common and easy to be.
You seem like quite a peppy person. Would you say
peppy, like jolly?
Yeah.
Yeah, when I'm... Certainly when I'm talking about things I care about, I can switch about. No, I mean, I got to a point in my life when I was a teenager where I just didn't want to live. And I didn't think I was worthy of life. And I was in so much pain and I hated everything. And then my answer to that was drugs and alcohol and trying to cover up and trying to cover up and trying to... And actually, I felt at the time that I was trying to live. And all I really wanted to do was live. You know, and I put them down in quite an extreme situation too. I got involved in a violent situation and just was like, I can't. Like, I'm not streetwise. Like, as much as I'm attracted to darkness, like, I'm a nice boy. Like, I'm not capable of being a cold-blooded, you know, gangster or dealer or whatever. And it wasn't until then that I met people who sort of challenged me in a good way and taught me how to love me. And I like life. Like, I like life and I care about things a lot. You know, and I think very intensely and deeply about most subjects, you know. And I think that I should be jolly. Like, not even should be. Like, I am. If I see something going in a nice way, I have a very positive worldview. I mean, but I also experience like really intense periods of depression and whatnot. But I think the longer I live with that, the more I'm able to sit with it. You know, even if it's painful at the time, and when you get through that, like, being jolly is great. I don't know.
So, I mean, I think we all know that autistic people are much more prone to depression than neurotypical people. Possibly there's something chemical to that, but more it's our situations generally. I'm just wondering, as you seem to have come through the other side of a seemingly hopeless situation, if you had any advice that you would give to someone who was feeling in a similar place?
Yeah, I was about to say I don't like giving advice, but on this one, yeah, I think it's the most important things that I have, or not even have, but like that I've experienced or been lucky enough to come across in my life is people who care or people who will tell you both the truth, but also offer you some support. And I mean good, I don't mean codependent support or like weird groomy support or like, because you know I've experienced all sorts of advice givers and stuff, but just like find someone who you think really gets you or who you can really talk to and who inspires you. You know, like, go and seek out the people, not that you necessarily want to be directly like, but that might have something that you want to learn. Or I think there's really no shame in if that person has that thing, and preferably not like the car or the shoes, but like something within themselves that you would like to be able to have, like contentness or some level of calm or a level of drive or something. I think like stick to those people, because if you stick around like other people who make you miserable or other people who... And this is why it's going into autism, and we can talk about it more. But if you are constantly challenged at every corner, you will get depressed. You know, it's just, for me, it seems like an inevitability. If any normal person would, anyone who's not, I'm sorry to use the word normal, but neurotypical, anyone who's not autistic, if they constantly came up against a barrier for the simplest thing all the time in their life, they would get confused and sad and depressed and therefore lonely. Mm. You know, it's... To me, it's a very simple, logical lead-on. Mm.
And who inspires you, and how did you meet them?
Ooh. I would say the first person who really inspired me, really inspired me when I quit drugs. And it was quite a big turning point in my life. And basically, I joined a 12-step fellowship, and it's not supposed to release his anonymity, but he's quite open about it, so I don't think he'll mind. But basically, when I was using drugs, I really wanted to be a club kid. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw the Party Monster documentary, and all I wanted was to be a club kid in New York, and, like, I'd never seen anything like that. Like, it was my first real insight into, like, queerness in a very, like, modern-day version of the word queer instead of just, like, muscly gay man thing. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I got clean, I met the guy who started those parties in recovery. And he is still, to this day, one of my biggest inspirations. He's so positive. He's so full of life. He's so generous. He just seems to have this, like, you know, and I've seen him in real moments as well. He's come to me, he's cried, like, he's a real human. He's not just a pasty mask. But he is a real pioneer for pushing people to be the best version of themselves, or encouraging them to do the maddest, weirdest, most off-key route to anything. He's like, why wouldn't that work? He's like, normal people take normal routes that leads them to normal ends. He's like, why would you not take the weird route to the fab thing that you really want to do? You know, and materialistically and experientially, he's got 2 platinum records. You know, he's made so many people famous. He writes songs for the most incredible people. He's got his own fashion label because he wants to. You know, it's just... And I know he's a very sort of like fab version of a person in... That's not always the most inspirational.
Larger than life, would you say?
Yeah, he's completely larger than life. But he's also not. He's as large as life. He is large like life. You know, he's not even unrealistic. He's just a great person who has actually gone and done great things. So he's one of them. The other is my neighbour Kelly in Margate. She's great. And I guess for similar reasons, like, she also just takes mad routes through things. But she's also had quite a mad life. Like, she's a West London girl. She grew up not in a modern posh sense. Like, she grew up in Shepherd's Bush and Acton. You know, she was a street kid. She is part gypsy, part Jamaican, you know. And she worked up through her life and ended up becoming, like, head teachers of schools, then called the school out because they were sort of, like, allowing, like, abuse and stuff to happen, and then opened her own school, and then got sex and relationships, like, the relationships part. She got that legislation passed.
Oh, wow.
So that could get put into schools, and then she became a furniture dealer, you know, and now, she's just great. She just vibes all day, you know, just really lived as well, and can still be soft and gentle and all of those things. So yeah, the first guy, who I'll remain unnamed, but anyone who's in the know, I'm sure will know who I'm talking about. And the second one is my neighbour Kelly, for sure. Lyrically, Patti Smith, Lou Reed, Courtney Love. All of those. Yeah.
Cool.
Hello, welcome to this conveniently timed commercial break. Did you know the Autistic Empire has a shop? We sell autistic themed merchandise, products by autistic artists, and useful things we think you'll find cool. Have you got difficulty getting your shoelaces to stay tied? Buy our one-tie shoelaces from Greepers that you can loosen and tighten without ever having to tie them again. Are you concerned about one-use straws but still want something to sip with? We have reusable straws from Glug Glug on sale now. T-shirts, badges, mugs, we've got it all, and it's all for autistic people by autistic people. All of our profits go towards employing Aspies and supporting the work of the Empire. We're a work in progress, so if you have feedback or would like to stock your products in our shop, please email sales@autisticempire.com. Everyone else, the address is shop.autisticempire.com. That's shop.autisticempire.com. We'll let you go back to the episode now. Thanks for listening.
So you're quite into people who are off the beaten path, as one might say.
I guess so. I don't think I have a choice in that.
Mm.
I think I'm into people who I relate to or see similarities in or sort of like see a route in their story that might help me on my way.
Mm.
You know, I guess I don't necessarily think I have a destiny as such, like in any sort of like written way, but I have noticed that when I don't follow a certain path, which might be indistinguishable, but I sort of know when I'm doing the right things
mm.
on that if I'm not doing that, I become quite unhappy. And I think those people who I've identified, yeah, they've like achieved the things that I would want to get through, I think. And
then,
yeah, and well, and if I'm me now, like, and if when I get to where they are in their life, I think I'd be pretty happy with where I'd got to, instead of living constantly wishing I'd done this or constantly wishing I'd tried that. They're people who have like gone at life and done it and still are doing it and will do more, you know, and then when they die, their legacy will probably live on as well.
There's something about being authentic.
So, 100%. Mm-hmm. And if you're not like, I know everyone's different, but for me that's like the biggest killer. If I'm not being authentic for any period of time, I just get sick, and it's like warning bells go off everywhere. Mm. I think also because I tried to be someone else when I was at dance school, and then I tried to be someone else when I was taking drugs. I tried to be someone else when I was at secondary school. You know, now I just don't have much time to be bothered to try something else.
Mm.
And it's kind of a matter of life or death. Like, I actually can't be someone else for too long.
Yeah. I really like that one. I'm going to write that one down.
But also, it's a bit of an oxymoron, because I also have identity crises all the time. So it's not like I really know who I am all the time. But certainly there's, like, a cloud in the air of stuff that I can... I don't know. I'm doing grabby hands right now. Like... not even cling on to, but like swim to the current. Yeah.
I'm reminded of Neil Gaiman's commencement speech that he gave, where he said, "Make good art. Whatever you do, make good art."
Yeah.
And you make art. You write poetry.
I do write poetry.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I love poetry. I know I hate poetry on the whole, but I love writing it.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's not true. My
identity crisis.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the word poetry comes with all these connotations and all these like whimsical, the grass green, the feather yellow, like all this stuff. But I always listened to a lot of rap growing up, and
modern
poetry. Yeah, what? But like in the best, I also like Spike Milligan. I like rhyming.
Oh God, You're sounding like me right about now.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't understand, like, school really kills this shit for you. Like, it just pulls it apart in the most docile. It's not even true. Like, I would write a really good poem at school, and they would be like, okay, let's analyze it. And they'd be like, we think you mean this by writing this, and you use this pattern here. I was like, no, I wrote a poem. Like, the words sounded good, and it came out my head. Poetry, like that, for me, that is the thing. And actually, yes, you can go back and edit a poem, but if you spend hours painstakingly writing something, like, it can't be a very authentic expression. You're trying to carve it too much, maybe.
So you're more one of those people who's like, you want to make sure you get it down rather than slave over one thing and then it's over to your liking. That's funny because I think there's a number of people, funny enough you say that, because there's a number of rappers who I can think like that who would just the kind of people, you know, you often hear the cliche thing of them in interviews saying they don't sleep, they're in the studio all the time up till like 2-3 in the morning just getting stuff done. But bizarrely, Tupac is somebody who comes to mind immediately for me, because he was somebody who was always constantly working, putting stuff down. It didn't matter who was in the studio with him, I think, right up until like sort of his last album, where they went in, where I think, if I remember right, according to the whole story, when he was at Death Row, they purposefully went into the studio, which was like where all the bad beat, which was known as where all the bad beats got made, and didn't work with any of his usual producers and stuff. But that lost him. I'm sorry, I'm taking it's just you're saying those two things, and I'm just like, is this me? especially because that's how I always kind of remember things, is like when you've listened to an obsessive amount of rap music, as I have in some ways, it's not just that you dissect things or you remember how things sound in a certain way. It's like the weird thing is, I remember when I got to sixth form and we were studying through certain things in poems and stuff like that, just like sibilance, plosive and stuff like that, there was always like a bar or something specific. I was like, oh wait, that was an example of that all this time, and I didn't know there was a word for it. So that was sort of a very interesting. Normally it's like you come to the technical stuff, and then you come to the technical terms, and then it's the stuff we see in action, where it was the other way around for me.
Yeah, me too, completely. Well, and like, I guess it's nice to have a word for that thing, but if I think of that word first, and I try and write something technically, it sort of kills my flow, or like my desire even to care. And like, I'm not saying like you can't spend hours shaping something afterwards, but for me the initial thing has to be like, right, I take a shit in the street and I walk away from it, you know. Also because if I stare at it for too long, I won't like it anymore, you know, or I'll adjust it too much, and then it doesn't sound like the right thing. So for me, yeah, like you just have to like bath it out onto a phone or onto paper or whatever, and there's, you know, even if that's your basic flow, your basic poem, your basic structure, that's what's there, and that's what you deal with. What, and I think for me particularly, like, the reason I find it so satisfying is, and particularly like Spike Milligan or like, I really love MF Doom. He's one of my favourite rappers, and he just, his wordplay is just so like chewy. Like, you just eat his words, because there's too many rhymes, there's too many syllables, but it completely works. You know, he's like,
add him to your collection of skulls and spines like Predator.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, there's so much. And also, like, half the time he just raps about food, you know, which I really, I mean, as a stoned kid, I really related. But also, like, just as a happy adult, it makes a lot of sense to me. But I think the reason I find it so cathartic is because I can express something in gobbledygook that people completely understand, you know, when they read it. Whereas if I try and say something in normal people language, they're like, what the fuck? You know, whereas if I've poeted it out, you know, even though it looks like gibberish. Yeah, for me it's like a complete communication breakthrough.
In an English class once, I was being disruptive, and my English teacher said, look, you can either do the work that we're doing in the class, which I thought was boring, or you can write a Shakespearean sonnet. And I was expecting me to comply and do whatever boring exercise it was, and I was like, yeah, no, alright, I'll write a sonnet. 14-line sonnet about commercialisation of Christmas, done in an hour. It's like one of the best poems I've ever written.
That sounds brilliant.
Yeah, it was good.
But you're right, it's completely rebellious, and I guess I've said amongst friends or other things as well, like, for me, like, dancing is one thing and it's brilliant, but I don't feel a particular desire to create dance. Like, I don't feel a particular desire to become a choreographer. I think it'd be nice if a couple of jobs came my way, but I don't feel the desire to create. Whereas with poetry, it says something that my dance can't. It says something that my body can't. And it says something that I can't with my normal words. You know, I'm not in the street, I wouldn't be able to go up to you and say, I was about to say, you to your face. Like, I wouldn't really want to do that anyways, but like, in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way, you can do that with poetry, you know, and you can lay it out. For example, I've got a poem called Seat Wiper, which is about people who go into the cubicle and then piss on the seat. It's like, just use the stand-up one, you know, it bugs me when people piss on the seat. But I'm printing that on posters, and I'm hopefully going to go and post it on those public loos on the inside of the cubicle. And it's very direct, and it's quite rude, but it's also quite funny. But I wouldn't be able to go and speak to all the men who piss on a seat in public and say, you're a d***head, wipe it up. But I can write a poem that says that for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I was just thinking that very civically minded of you.
I am quite civically minded. You know, there is something about, like, in some ways, like, it's really fun to break rules, and, like, I often don't like systematic things. But there are some, you know, it's like, being autistic, it's hard to understand many rules and boundaries. But there are some that, to me, just make complete sense. Like, if you follow the traffic rules, that might help. You know, if you drive according to the rules of the road, and if everyone did it, it would make sense. In Morocco, no one does it. And it also works, because no one does it. You know, and they just find their own flow. In the UK, some people follow the rules, and then other people don't, and that screws the system. I'm fine with the road rules system. I'm not fine with systematic oppression, but I don't really think that the traffic rules are a problem. In a loo, if you've made a loo for people to use, it really should, especially if it's a cubicle, it should have loo roll in it. The door should lock. You shouldn't have to, like, put your foot up against the door and then find a tissue maybe somewhere mysterious, or call someone in the restaurant to come and help you out. I know we've, like, diverted quite seriously. Maybe I should have put my special interest as loos.
No, I thought that was absolutely awesome.
I have quite a toilet. I'm very scatological. I always talk about my stomach because that's something that actually affects me a lot. But also toilets as, like, sacred spaces. It's definitely relevant. Like, maybe this is the space finally where I don't have to apologise for talking about my poo all day. But it's in a lot of my poems. There's always a poo reference.
How transgressive of you.
Yeah.
Cool. If people wanted to read your poetry, where would they go, Ted?
I have a blog, which I haven't really written much on recently, but it does have a lot of poetry on it, called artpornblog.com. And I have written a book called Can You Smell Gas, which technically you can buy on artpornshop.bigcartel.com, but I need to get a printer so I can reprint it first, because I hand bind them, and I lost my printer in the move, so I don't actually have means of doing it. But if you did go and order one,
you would bind one.
I would find means to print and bind you a poetry book.
Oh, that sounds
so
cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so the only other thing that I really wanted to ask you about was that you said that you had a special interest in philosophy. And so I was going to, because I know you said to me before we started recording that philosophy kind of infuses everything that you do.
Yeah.
So I guess my first question would be, what philosophy are you most into?
Yeah.
And the second one is, philosophy is really about trying to systematize the world, and you said that you're very against that, so I was quite interested in the dichotomy there.
Yeah, okay. I think that's a really good question, but I think I have a good answer.
Okay.
I do love philosophy, and I do think that it links everything. The reason I don't think it's a dichotomy is because I don't think that all philosophers try and systemize the world. Sometimes I think they try and systemize the world, or if they do systemize, they take quite a wide perspective on it, and they at least quite bravely or hopefully, like filled with hope, hopefully try to find a system that will work for more people, you know, or a system that works in a new ideal. And I know idealism is tricky and you have to work with reality, but I like to try and find where the two marry. And I think in modern society, we use philosophy in quite a dark way. Like, we use it to market, we use it to sell. We lie to the people about how we can feed it back to them when really it doesn't. I don't know, that's quite a skeptical view.
Where would you say the philosophy is in that? Because I've always assumed that when such things occur in government, it's largely out of greed rather than any kind of planned belief system. Although I suppose greed is good, it's certainly a belief system.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe there's a baseline greed, but I think in order to act those things, the government actually has to be very clever about how it does that. I don't particularly like Machiavelli or The Prince as a book, but even in that he describes...
I do.
Yeah. Well, I don't like really dislike it, but I prefer Nietzsche, which other people would say is similar to Machiavellian philosophy. But certainly, like, the way he describes how you would have to be as a ruler in order to get the people to do the end goals. Like, it's not a straightforward... It's not like, tell the people to do this and this will happen. You know, it's a sort of form of plan or a manipulation to reach an end goal. So I think people in government at that high level actually have to be extremely clever and knowledgeable, even if they're not as individuals. They have to be fed the information in order for them to enact greed. They can't just be greedy on a base level.
Okay. Who would you prefer?
As a government?
No. Who would you prefer philosophy to this is
problematic because they're both white men, and I've been challenging myself to read more female and of colour philosophers and actually find them in a mainstream bookshop, which can sometimes prove a challenge. But I like what Nietzsche says, but I don't necessarily think he should run a country. I just like him because I think he's a really accurate little bitch who says things that are so cutting, but you just can't argue with them because you're just like, oh, that's really true. You know, I think he's got very, very witty and I fully think he's autistic as well.
Really?
Because he just says things in such a beautifully blunt way. Not a blunt baseline way, but in a very, what I would identify, and I guess that's my opinion or my experience, is like quite nuanced, autistically blunt way that says it exactly how it is that other people just can't express. So I really like Nietzsche and relate to reading to Nietzsche. But I think in terms of running a country, I'm not sure. I've drawn on many things. I mean, Plato's Republic is interesting, but I don't wholeheartedly think that it would work in modern day society. And that's perhaps where using a bit of Machiavelli would be useful, because he looks at what's actually there and how to work off that. But I do like the idea that philosopher kings would be in charge instead of people who want to be in charge, because then you would have, I guess, the theory behind that, or the way I understand it from reading The Republic is, and let me try and be more articulate for listeners as well, is instead of having someone who wants to be in charge, you have a philosopher king in charge, or a group of philosopher kings. And a philosopher king is someone who doesn't necessarily want to be in charge, but does know what is probably best for most people. And therefore, you skip the greed bit, and it sticks with a truthful and as much as possible, and a willingness to run things in a way that will hopefully work. also within that a way that is flexible, because philosophers are intrinsically thinkers. They are people who think. They are people who explore ideas and think stuff through and read history and take new perspectives. And that also opens thought and possibility. Whereas I think people who want to be in power decide things, might consider a few options, but essentially cut down a lot of possibility and shut a lot of things off. And they might have found a way that sort of works for most people, but most people in their view is not really considering all the people they could unleash in a positive way. So I guess, yeah, a mix of things. But for me, the use of philosophy in it is just in the thinking and in the seeking. Like I said, it's an opening thing. And for example, the way that relates to autism for me and queerness is in thinking about how those people work, you will understand how to unlock their positive features. Whereas in thinking they're disordered, you have already shut them down. You have already shut down the possibility. It used to be illegal to be gay. So you shut those people down and then they're miserable and unhappy and die. You know, we have quite high death rates for various reasons. Suicide, HIV, you know, drug use, all of it. Whereas if you, when you don't make that illegal anymore, you know, and also there's a lot of education and healing and recovery and stuff that needs to happen in there, you unlock the positivity that those people have to offer. So for me, if you took a philosophical versus a systematic view on autism, you would unlock all of those people instead of shutting that down. And the final thing is, after you've unlocked that, you learn more yourself. Because once you've unlocked that, you've got to learn what those people know. So it's an expansive knowledge, which is another thing that philosophy champions, is an expansive knowledge as opposed to a shutdown of knowledge. So I think that's why I'm so fascinated by it. And also it's personally empowered me to think in very, like, abstract, longitudinal, I mean, ways for me which actually feel completely logical, and I don't understand why other people don't do them. But it's unlocked my ability to really think around things and offer a perspective that, said in a sentence, sounds so simple.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but other people haven't thought of it.
Do you have any questions?
No, not really, other than that was a good, that was a nice thing to sort of soak in and listen to, really.
In which case, Ted, I would ask you, what would you recommend someone read as a baseline book?
If okay.
They were going to,
I mean,
try to follow you in this.
I'll give a sensible answer and then my favourite answer.
All right.
Okay, so the sensible answer would be The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant. Because it gives an outline, again, disclaimer, of white European male philosophers from ancient times up until fairly recent centuries that allows you to sort of kind of understand the gist of their main work, and then you could work through that book and pick a philosopher that you resonated with and start with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's quite a good, like, all-encompassing brick that will open you out. And then my favourite answer would be Symposium and the Death of Socrates, because it's the first one that I really read, and I love Socrates' dialectic. I love his arguing people around in circles, and I love his strength. He gets sentenced to death, and he's like, you know, his name lives on 3,000 years later.
If people want to stay in touch with you or find any of your work, you've mentioned artpornblog.com.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
I have an Instagram, which is artpornblog,
mm-hmm.
which you could DM me on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Facebook, but I kind of hate social media.
Mm.
Well, I have a very love-hate relationship with it. But certainly, if you message me via Instagram, I would probably respond if it's an autism-related question as opposed to a come-on, which can be quite tricky because sometimes Instagram's like the new Grindr. And I do have an email, but I would say, like, speak to me on Instagram and then I'll give you my email.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that we'll draw that one to a close then. Thank you so much for coming on, Ted. That was incredibly informative and useful. And I particularly want to remind everyone that you can't be someone else and you need to pursue the weird route to the fab thing that you really want to do. Brilliant piece of advice.
Good.
So thank you very much. We will record another episode. And thank you very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.